Hello, I'm Jane Crowther, editor of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. And today I'm joined by our online editor, Jack Shepherd.
Hello.
Hello. We've had a bit of a trauma, haven't we, getting online here with the headphones and all sorts of things. It's not all glamour at the Total Film office.
But
this week we are talking to Amy Lou Wood about festival hit period drama Living. Plus, we're reviewing That, The Wonder, Enola Holmes 2, Call Jane, and Weird, the Al Yankovic story. But before we get onto those, what have you been watching this week, Jack? Apart from all of the homework I've set you.
Apart from all the homework, I've been watching a lot of television recently. So We've just finished Lord of the Rings, which I enjoyed despite lots of people not enjoying it. I thought it was very good, especially the ending. There's some really good twists and turns. House of the Dragons just come to an end as well. Yeah. So I've been living my best fantasy life.
This is a nightmare for me, both of these shows. I hate fantasy.
House of the Dragons is very good. It's very serious. It's very Game of Thrones, as you would expect.
Wigs, though. The wigs, Jack.
Oh, man. Especially like early on, some of the wigs are real bad, but they do some recasting and they get better. But yeah, if you can't get over the wigs, you may struggle in places. But Matt Smith is so good in this show. He's just brilliant. So I'm on a prequel kick, apparently, because I've also been watching Andor, which we've just watched the 10th episode, and it is incredible. It's just brilliant. It's probably my favorite Star Wars show so far. I think it's really, really good, really well done, very Blade Runner-y, very serious, makes the Empire really, really evil. It's just filmed and scripted so well, and it takes it very seriously. It takes the source material very seriously, and the only issue with it is that I kind of wish it was exploring a different part of the Star Wars timeline. You know, we've done this mid-period so much. But yeah, it's surprising to me that this is the least watched Star Wars show as well. Well, maybe unsurprising, because it's not about, you know, Baby Yoda or Boba Fett or Obi-Wan Kenobi, and instead about this random character from Rogue One. But it is very good.
And are you excited for where they'll take it? They obviously have plans to take this into a next season and where it might go from here.
I think so. I mean, we know where it's going to go, right?
Of course. We know the end. Rogue One. We know the end point, but we do have a journey. They've promised us a journey to there.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of the characters they've introduced are very interesting and very good and just really well acted. The cast is stacked and they're all... they feel so lived in. The world feels just very visceral. I am excited to see where it goes. I am slightly disappointed that I know how it will eventually end, but there's kind of no getting around that. And the way they've explored it is very interesting. I mean, this is the kind of the issue with prequels in general, right?
Yeah.
We know where they're ending and it's all about the journey. And the journey in all three of these shows has been worth the exploration. But I would like, if we're going to keep doing this with these franchises, to push out into the future. This is why The Mandalorian, although not as good a show, is perhaps more exciting, because we don't really know where it goes.
Mm.
Although we obviously have Rise of Skywalker and Force Awakens and all that, the stories are so different and don't have any crossover characters really that it feels all fresh and we don't know where it's going, and that makes it really exciting. You know, we don't know who Baby Yoda is going to be one day. Like, is he going to speak backwards? Is he going to have a green lightsaber? Who knows?
Who knows?
So that's exciting.
It is.
Anyway, there's my morning rant about Star Wars and fantasy.
Here endeth the lesson from Jack. Yes. Shall we move on to what we can watch then this week on a bigger screen than what you've been watching those on? It's time to get your bowler hat out. It's this.
But he's never late. Something must have happened.
Mr. Williams?
Tis you.
I was thinking lunch at Fortnum's.
Fortnum's?
Why not?
Mr. Williams, I'll tell you my secret nickname for you. Mr. Zombie.
Mr. what?
Zombies are sort of dead, but not dead.
Well, sir, it's time to live a little.
So this is Living, the remake of Ikiru, following a 1950s pen-pushing bureaucrat played by Bill Nighy, whose medical diagnosis prompts him to live a little. Before we talk about the film, though, let's hear what Amy Lou Wood, who plays vibrant secretary in Nighy's stuffy old office, had to say when Jordan Farley sat down with her earlier this week.
How would you describe a Kazuo Ishiguro screenplay? Is it a great piece of literature in its own right?
Oh, God, yeah. It's remarkable how vividly he can draw, like, character and place in so few words. Mm. Like, you know exactly who someone is in their first sentence that they speak. You know, it's such a gift for an actor because you just know who that human is. You know, the first bit of dialogue that they have is so evocative and so like it's just so beautifully drawn and well put that so much of your work is done for you from the first read, you know, and that's what I think is so wonderful about him. And also he's got such a distinctive voice and you just kind of know it's his. As soon as you start reading it, it feels like him. And whilst also being able to create these amazing characters, it also has so much of him in it, which I just think the best writers do that. And he is one of the best, of course.
Yeah, I completely agree. You play Margaret Harris, the effervescent colleague of Bill Nighy's Mr. Williams. She leaves her comfortable but deeply boring local government job for something a little bit riskier but potentially more fulfilling. Acting itself is a risky profession. You're betting on your own ability to succeed when there are no guarantees. Could you relate to Margaret in that sense?
I find her so aspirational and inspiring. You know, Oliver, our director, kind of, when I got the part, he said, "You are Margaret." To me, you know, to him, he thought that we were very similar. And I was extremely moved and grateful that he thought that, because I do not see myself like Margaret at all. I wish I was more like Margaret, but I can definitely be frozen in time. I can be totally indecisive. I can get lost in my head for weeks on end, you know, worrying about the past, worrying about the future. Whereas it was so nice to kind of be inside of Margaret, inside of a character that is so, you know, I'm going to do this. I'm going to try it. I'm going to experience this. I'm going to go for it. She's got a lot of dynamic forward momentum. And that was really pleasant to step into for a while. But I relate to her in terms of, I feel like I am quite a curious person and people do interest me endlessly. So I do think we're similar in that way. But in terms of her courage and her ability to be present and in the here and now, I'm working on that.
It's good to hear. You spend most of the time on screen with Bill Nighy. Bill Nighy is transcendent in the film, really the role of a lifetime. I've seen the film twice now, and both times he's left me bereft in the best way. What was it like having a front row seat to that performance?
Oh my God. Some days it was almost too much. the scene in the pub, I mean, I was just crying for hours after we wrapped filming. Honestly, I couldn't believe what I had just seen and experienced. And he's that actor who is so real. He's so embodied as the character that you don't have to act when you're with him. Like, there's no acting required. You just respond to what he's giving you. He's a deeply generous actor in that way that you're always surprised as well. So we did that scene so many times, and every time there was something in it that completely surprised me, because he's so in it. He's so responsive to the actor sat in front of him and to the words that he's saying and the environment that he's in. He's so responsive and so open. With Bill, I wanted to just do the scenes over and over and over and over and over again. I just wanted more, because every time there would be something so new and brilliant, and he's just endlessly, there's so much depth to Bill that you could kind of just act with him doing the same scene 100 times and it would never, ever get old and it would never get boring. And that's a pretty remarkable thing to experience. And it's also deeply inspiring. He takes great care in his work. You know, he really does. He really is so detailed in his work, but he doesn't talk about it, which I love. He doesn't talk about, you know, his process or anything like that. He would much rather talk about life and us as people rather than acting. But you can tell that such care and tenderness and detail has gone into the work that he's done.
Our listeners will probably know you best as Amy in Sex Education, of course. Living in some ways couldn't be more different. Were you actively looking for different kinds of stories to tell on screen when Living came your way?
Definitely. I went to drama school, and for 3 years you just play such a range of characters. You do such a range of stories. You're kind of spoiled at drama school. One day you'll be playing a 50-year-old, and the next day you're playing a 10-year-old. You know, it's like there's such a huge range. And I think that it can be a bit of a shock when you leave after those 3 years, and you kind of, it can be a bit saddening, I think, for people that isn't just available to you anymore, and that there's a lot of kind of gatekeepers and all that stuff. And I think that, you know, sex education, it has been the biggest gift in so many ways, but you start acting because you want to tell stories, and you want to tell many, many, many stories. So I think that, I definitely have been mindful to pick things in between the filming of Sex Education, the seasons, that have been very different. So like Uncle Vanya, mm-hmm. and like trying to keep in touch with like my theatre side. And then I've also did this medieval comedy. So I've tried to keep it very much different to Amy on the in-between bits. It also keeps it in perspective, because it can become very much like every article that's written about you next to it is sex education, sex education, sex education. So it can be very much like, but I've done lots of other things. So I think it is really important to, have a range of characters and stories that you're telling.
So that was Amy Lou Wood talking about her character who sort of befriends Bill Nighy's stuffy bureaucrat. Fill us in on sort of where we find this character, Jack.
Well, so this is directed by Oliver Hermanos and written by Kazuo Ishiguro, whose last screenplay was The White Countess, the James mm-hmm. Ivory movie. But he's better known as Nobel Prize winner and author of Remains of the Day. It's Bill Nighy's pen pusher, as you say, the bureaucrat. He's head of a planning office for a constituency in London. There's a new recruit on his desk, played by Alex Sharp, who's curious about how things work, and things don't really work in this office. Things get pushed around from one place to the next, but something happens to Mr. Williams, Bill Nighy's character, whose life is changed by this diagnosis. So he goes on this little trip to Brighton, meets Tom Burke's mysterious boozer, has a whirlwind weekend, and comes back and he's just devastated, doesn't really know how to live his life. And after an intervention by Amy Lou Wood's character, he has a slight change of mind, and kind of his life has a mission, you could say. I mean, this is all very, very familiar plotting to anyone who's watched the original Akira Kurosawa's Akira. I really love the original film. I think it was quite bold to try and remake a Kurosawa movie. I mean, we've got the change of setting to London. That makes complete sense. The period setting, it does look amazing.
It's gorgeous.
And it's so well filmed. I found it a really life-affirming, well-made, well-scripted story. It perhaps tones down some of the melancholy of the original, though I would argue kind of becomes perhaps less effective because of that, but only just. I still really liked it. What did you think, Jane?
Boring.
Oh no. Really?
Yeah, sorry. It really does give you a really good sense of this sort of bureaucratic office that they work in, where, you know, you take your T5 form up to this planning office. They say, oh no, you can't do that because you haven't got this form. So you go back down, you take the paper down there, and then somebody else takes it and it goes on a desk and it sits in an in-tray. But that, I felt, was a little bit like what the film was. It was just going through the motions, and the resolution of what it is that he puts his mind to as his mission was so bewildering to me, and such a rubbish outcome. I understand it's about more than that thing that he does achieve. No spoilers here. But it just felt so sort of underwhelming. And so I could appreciate it. I could see how beautiful it was and how meticulously made it was and all of that. But it didn't set me on fire, and I just found it really quite forgettable.
Oh no. I thought Bill Nighy was so good in it, and that he was so watchable. I don't know. I really like the wholesomeness of the story. It's perhaps a little slow, but I actually quite like the look into a man's life and what you reflect on, and actually made me analyze my own and why I'm doing what I'm doing what are the outcomes we actually want? Are we just pushing things around so we don't have to do much? And what do we actually want to achieve?
Do we need to have a little talk, you and I? I feel like you're about to have like a spiritual crisis about your job at Total Film.
I came to the conclusion that I'm very happy with my job at Total Film, obviously, and that I want to do more podcasts. So I'm here doing it, living. I really liked it. I think it's very slight film. And again, it's pretty much exactly the same as the original. And I think that was probably my main issue, was that I do really, really like the original. And it made me very weepy the first time I saw that. This did not. It wasn't as effective. Maybe it's perhaps because it's in London and maybe it's too close to home. Whereas watching Kurosawa's, a timepiece that's from Japan, it kind of transports you away. Whereas this didn't transport me away. I knew half the locations. The movie opens and I was like, oh, that's the Bluebell Railway down south. And oh, that looks a bit like Brighton. It's not Brighton, but it pretends to be Brighton. And then there's like, oh, we're outside Waterloo Station now. I recognize that doorway. Yes. I've walked through there. So it didn't really have that aspect to it for me. It was perhaps a little too close to home. But as I say, I did still really like it. And I think if you haven't seen the original, then it'll do things that it didn't do for me, because I had seen the original.
I can barely remember the original, and all it did was make me want to go and watch that again and think, why have we taken this much effort to sort of transpose this to London? What is it about the original that makes it such a classic? And so in that way, I suppose it's rewarding for me, because it made me watch the original again. It's one of those classic, slow, beautifully made British period pieces, which I know that people love. And I'm sure there are people that will go to the cinema and get a great deal out of this and might have a sort of epiphany in the cinema. But I did not. And I really wanted to feel that.
I can totally see where you're coming from. Most people who I've spoken to have seen this really, really liked it. Actually, it's been quite mixed on our team, hasn't it? I know Jordan Farley really liked it. Matt Mayton was less keen, I believe.
Yeah.
So maybe it's a 50-50. Maybe it's a roll the dice and see if you come away with it.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's going to be a gamble whether you find it transforming or completely boring. But, you know, it's also a very awardsy film, isn't it, Jack?
Yes, Bill Nighy, especially in contention for Best Actor. I imagine he's almost certain to be in the BAFTA running. We love a good British icon running in a good film.
Stiff upper lip.
Yeah, I think he's definitely in there. The Oscars, not so sure. The listeners can't see, but you're crossing your hair. You're just like, no, that's not happening.
They're not gonna go for this, I don't think, at all. I mean, you know, Nighy has done loads of good work, and he's at that stage in his career now that he might get awards based on this being delightful to some people, but also the craft involved in the film, and his due possibly some recognition. But I just don't think it's one that's going to cross to the Oscars. Do you?
I agree with you. Unless it's he's done his time, we need to award him Oscar, then it's just not going to happen. I do think he's really good. I think he's really understated in this. I love Bill Nighy in lots of things.
Mm.
It's not very showy. There's perhaps one scene, one very, very good scene between him and Amy Lou that is perhaps like the Oscar scene, if they're going to put one forward to be, you know, oh, it's a bit weepy, oh, I'm getting quite emotional. But overall, I think it's too subtle. I just don't think it's quite got it. He almost needs to do a big biopic and get into lots of makeup and stuff like that to really get into the Oscar awards, maybe. But I think there's too many other performances like Austin Butler and Elvis or Brendan Fraser and The Whale, that kind of thing, that will just overshadow this.
Yes, yes. It is very restrained, which is possibly why I didn't love it. I found it a little too buttoned down for me. But if you fancy a bit of living, then it is out in cinemas on Friday. Right, shall we move on with more period drama? What's Miss Flo up to? It's this.
Thumbs up. And eyes wide open. Are you nervous at all?
Why should I be nervous?
Do you know the dangers of a prolonged fast, Anna?
I don't eat sweets. I live a manna. From heaven.
And how does that feel?
Full.
Anna is in danger.
She's an actress.
She's chosen.
Are you feeling well in yourself, Anna?
Very well, Father. Thank you.
What right does a stranger have to come between a child and his people?
I'm here to find out the truth.
So this is The Wonder, which stars lovely Florence Pugh, who's, you know, there's been some column inches about her in the last few weeks. Have we noticed this? I don't know. Jack, what is she doing in this? It's quite a different swerve away from Don't Worry, Darling, isn't it?
Yes. So she plays Nurse Lib, who is a nurse who's sent from mainland UK to Ireland to watch a quote unquote miracle girl who has apparently not eaten anything in months. This girl lives in a secluded house with her family, who are, to put it bluntly, quite suspect in this whole situation. There's a board of directors and officials paying close attention to what's happening, including some clergymen and a doctor played by Toby Jones. And Miss Flo's Lib thinks that there's more at play here than just a miracle. She's kind of a very straightforward, uses science, wants to know the truth. And she goes full detective mode in this and tries to find out what's happening. So she's staying in a local pub and she's pestered by a journalist played by Tom Burke. So it's
who
a double,
writes for the Telegraph.
Who writes for the Telegraph, but it's a double Tom Burke week.
It
so
is.
He's, which is fun because I think he's great. And I think he's great in both of these. But yeah, so The Wonder's directed by Sebastian Lelio, who did A Fantastic Woman. And this is kind of like Living. It's a beautiful period piece. With this amazing set design, amazing costumes, wonderful cinematography. Here it's very grainy. There's some Irish hills to look at. It looks spectacular. And Florence Pugh is amazing in it. She's so great. She's very, I guess, stoic, but she's also, there are some eating scenes, and the amount of emotion she gets over in these eating scenes is amazing. You know, if there's going to be one Florence Pugh performance we should be talking about this year, it's this one, really. I really enjoyed this movie as well. I thought the framing of it as well was really interesting because the movie starts literally the first scene, so it's not a spoiler. It starts with a shot of the studio as a whole, so it makes you think like, oh, this is a film, and it shows you kind of like behind the curtain before luring you into the rest of the story, and it's really effective. So I really like this one as well. What did you didn't think this one was boring, did you, Jane?
I loved this one. Okay. I love Miss Flo. I think she can do no wrong, and you know, she's the strongest thing in Don't Worry, Darling, in her wheelhouse of playing strong, complicated women who have their own agency. And no matter what time period they're in, they are fighting for their own sort of story. And this is Victorian time, so she's in the corset like Little Women again. You know, as a nurse who is a Nightingale nurse and has, you know, witnessed war and has secrets of her own, she is not about to accept that faith is the answer in this. And I think there's a lot of parallels that you can draw between the idea of storytelling, which goes through this film, as you said, through the very opening of saying, we invite you to believe in this story. So it's already asking you what you should and shouldn't believe. And then this detective story, as Lib tries to work out what on earth is going on here, whether it's divine intervention or deception, that I think is really interesting in the world we're living in at the moment, what with Elon Musk and Twitter and all of that and social media, that we constantly have to ask ourselves, what do we believe? And are we able to change our mind about things as well? Or are we, you know, just going to believe one thing and it doesn't matter what evidence we're given? So the news cycle of today, I feel, is really weirdly pertinent to this. And yeah, and as you say, Florence Pugh, I mean, we open with her eating a stew on a ship. And the way she eats that stew weirdly tells you everything you need to know about that character. It's quite incredible what she can do. And as you mentioned, Tom Burke as well, their relationship in this I found really engaging and, you know, torrid. And I wanted the best for these characters. So, yeah, I think it's really good. And it's going to be on Netflix, isn't it, in a couple of weeks. So it's having this limited run in the cinema. But as you say, the look of it is so beautiful. I would absolutely want to see this on a big screen, as I did. I was fortunate to see it on a big screen. because it's worth it to see her stomping across the moors in her little blue dress. It's gorgeous. And it sort of reminded me, I don't know if it did with you, of like a flip side to Lady Macbeth, which is the film that she sort of broke out with as a Victorian woman in a very similar era, but a very different character. They feel like sort of flip sides of the same coin.
Yeah, and it just the whole look of it as well, very similar in many respects. I mean, it is interesting that a movie about story and narrative with Florence Pugh in the center,
well, yeah,
is coming out now. You know, we've kind of gone through this massive media phase with everyone talking about her in this really weird, heightened way. All the stuff about Don't Worry, Darling, whether it's Chris Pine spitting on Harry Styles, like
other way around, Jack, get with it.
I mean,
who's spitting on who? Like, who's having a Aperol spritz and not attending a press conference? Who's got their team wearing Miss Flo t-shirts? All of this narrative is a big thing with Florence Pugh at the moment. So it is very interesting, as you say.
It's all over my head. Don't worry, darling. So I'm just like, okay, I'm just putting my head down. Can't be bothered to get engaged. But I was really surprised at how bold that opening was, but also how I was lured into my brain, clicking into the film and being like, this is the story. This is how it's happening. This is, and then
this is real. You sort of immediately think this is real. I'm watching the Victorian times. I've already like suspended my disbelief.
Yeah, exactly. And it's surprising come the end again, when it kind of puts questions in your face once more about what's real and what's true. It does. It's very thought provoking. It is always hard to imagine these films that look so good and are so and play so well on a big screen. Because I also saw on the big screen, going on to such as, you know, watching it on your telly or your phone or something like that when it's on Netflix, because it does feel like one that should be in cinemas. It has that big feel to it as well. But yeah, I really enjoyed this. I think. Is this one going to be an awards contender, do you think, Jane?
I'd love to see her get some awards traction for it, because I just think she's exceptional and she's just at the height of her powers at the moment. I mean, she got awards buzz around Little Women and went all the way to the Oscars with that, but obviously didn't win it. I don't think she'd win it with this, but I think she should certainly be in the conversation, don't you?
Yeah, again, like Bill Nighy in Living, it's not a hugely showy performance. You know, it's a lot of sitting in rooms and talking. It's obviously another movie that was made during COVID. So, you know, the cast list is limited. A lot of it takes place in this young girl's room where she's trying not to eat. And Florence Pugh's just looking at her being like, how are you doing this? There's a lot of that. There's a lot of walking around the moors. You know, it is a really powerful, but again, understated performance where something like eating can tell you everything you need to know, but there's not that big showy scene that I always associate with the performances that go on to the Oscars, you know. So again, it's maybe one that could get her a BAFTA nom, but maybe not Oscars.
Yeah, which would be a shame. It's interesting that you mentioned the whole idea of everybody sort of looking at this girl as well. I think you could probably talk about this in terms of, you know, body autonomy for women as well. It's quite an interesting sort of parallel there, that all of these elder men of the community, be they doctors, priests, you know, farmers, you know, someone who's a rich man, even the man from the Telegraph, all feel they have a say in what should be done with this girl and the parents. And yet she doesn't seem to have any control over her own body and her own destiny. And without giving away spoilers, I found the thing that happens in the final third to be incredibly moving, and the power of storytelling, that it isn't just a bad thing. Yeah, I don't want to say more, but I found it delicious. Every aspect of it, just there was nothing wrong with this film.
The young girl in this, Keela Lord-Cassidy, I believe is her name.
Yeah,
she's great. She's one to watch because she's fantastic in this, and as kind of an ill young woman who has so much conviction in her own faith, and to be acting against Florence Pugh in many of these scenes, you know, to hold her own, it's really impressive.
Yeah. And her mother, Elaine Cassidy, plays her real mother in the film as well. So to see that sort of interaction between the two that reflects their real relationship is really quite lovely as well. All right, so if you fancy a bit of The Wonder, it is out in select cinemas on Friday and it will hit Netflix on Wednesday, the 16th of November. We urge you to watch it on a big screen. And then if you watch it on Netflix, the biggest screen in your house, because it is a beauty. Right, the game's afoot again with this.
Is it true you find lost people?
Yes.
My sister, she disappeared a week ago.
At last, I would be a detective in my own right, worthy of the home's name.
Dare I ask?
She's a detective.
Good God, another one.
I'm trying to save a girl's life.
And what can we do?
We...
So this is Enola Holmes 2, starring Superman again. Jack, what's Enola up to this time?
Enola's back. She's back. Minnie Bobby Brown's Enola's back. The sister to the famous Sherlock. They solved a case in the first movie, and now Enola started her own detective agency, though she's struggling to find clients because they all want her famous brother to be dealing with these things. And they keep thinking they've got the wrong Sherlock. It's quite funny. It's quite annoying. But eventually, Enola does find a case that's ready for her when a young girl who works at the matchstick factory comes along with a missing persons case. Enola finds herself embroiled in the shady underworld of London, where also her brother Sherlock is investigating his own case. And the two eventually, they don't really want each other's help, but they kind of need each other's help in parts. To say anything more, I don't want to go into the story because it is a twisty, turny tale, as you would expect from a Sherlock story. But thrown into the mix here, you've got Louis Partridge's Viscount Tewkesbury, who you'll remember as the will they, won't they love interest from the first movie, who's now properly part of the House of Lords. You've got David Thewlis as a conniving evil officer of the Scotland Yard, who's hamming it up immensely, but it's a lot of fun. Helena Bonham Carter and Susie Wacoma as Enola's mother and her former carer, both back, but almost in kind of cameo roles here, though they do have one very good scene with Enola. You've also got Adil Akhtar as Lestrade, who's the famous Scotland Yard officer from the books. And there's also newcomer Sharon Duncan Brewster, newcomer to this series. She was best known for Dune before, but she's kind of a servant to the one of the lords looking after the match factory. She's got her own thing going on, and she interacts with Enola in an interesting way. I mean, it's twisty turny, as you'd expect. It's a lot of fun. I thought it was very similar to the first one. Minnie Bobby Brown's on, you know, charm offensive here. Henry Cavill's, you know, huge, hulking, muscly Sherlock, who you could tell who he is from his shoulders, as someone says in the movie. You know, I mean, some of the clues and puzzles are definitely overwrought in places. Some of them, there's one with like maps and symbols that went way above my head. I was like, I don't understand what's happening here. I don't really understand how anyone's worked this out, but it's fine. I'm just going to go along with it. And some of the messaging is very in your face, especially towards the end. Some of it's like, okay. Yeah, we do get it. Again, it's, you know, it's harmless fun. And I think I'm not really the biggest fan of, I mean, other than Stranger Things, we haven't seen Millie Bobby Brown in that much, apart from like Godzilla, which wasn't very good. But I do find her really charming in this. And I think Henry Cavill does a really good job. There's one scene where he's a drunk Sherlock in this, and it's a lot of fun. And he's obviously having fun in the role. And I quite like that. It's much less serious than Superman or The Witcher or anything like that. So I had fun with this. I thought it was fine.
You know, full points for creating a franchise that is something that little girls can watch and, you know, develop their feminist ideology and understand that they can be someone. Brilliant. I love Billy Bobby Brown's sort of looks to camera and fourth wall breaking. I love seeing Henry Cavill do his comedy, and his, as you say, that tipsy scene is very amusing, and I love the banter between the two of them. But I didn't love this film. All the elements were there, but it didn't quite hang together. It's 2 hours long. I felt like it had multiple endings, and I just didn't find the denouement very satisfying. I felt like I'd put in a lot of work with all of the different puzzles to solve, and what I actually ended up with, who had been at it, was a bit so I was sort of underwhelmed.
there was one twist in particular. It was so obvious. Yeah. There's like one certain like character revelation, and it's just like, oh yeah, yeah. How did you not see that? Well, it's like right there. And then the rest of the time, they're doing, especially Sherlock, as I said, this map thing that he does where he's suddenly putting letters together and all this stuff. And you're just like, whoa, this is a lot. Like even Benedict Cumberbatch's version wouldn't do this. You kind of go along with it because they are also charming and nice and it's fun. And it's a really well-made world. It is very similar to the first. It's the same feeling as you're watching it, though you're right. When it all comes together, it's not quite as satisfying as in the first one. You know, it's still funny though, and there's some of the fourth wall breaking is very good and well done. I normally find it really annoying. Like I found it quite annoying in She-Hulk, but I actually think it really works here. You know, it's like the Fleabag effect of everyone's doing fourth wall breaking now. But no, I think it's good here. And you know, some of the cameos and characters who come along, it's like playing with the mythology of Sherlock as well, in an interesting way that is new and still, you know, doesn't feel worn out, even though we've seen so many versions of that character and some of these characters. But it definitely still feels like a fresh spin, and it feels like a good franchise. You know, I'm not against them making more of these and watching more of them, because I think it's just a fun put it on Netflix movie, watch it with the fam. It's fine.
I think that's probably what I feel about this one. It feels like a stepping stone to something else. And maybe the third one would be really great because they'd have got in their groove. And also we're left with a post-credit sting, no spoilers, that suggests certainly more of these. So yeah, it feels like it's just the film that gets you to the next one. And then maybe this franchise will get stronger and stronger as it goes. But it didn't do it for me as a standalone.
That's fair. I mean, it does feel like a series where it's just going to be case of the week, you know, but in movie form. But was this case kind of overthought? And it just doesn't have any real teeth, does it? It's just a nice movie. There's not really too much peril. You're never like worried that Enola's going to die or something like that. I don't know. The Sherlock series as a whole, you look at Cumberbatch's version, even Robert Downey Jr.'s and all these classic ones, and they've often got something a bit slightly...
They've got Moriarty. Sinister. Moriarty, yes. Is what we want. Or the Hound of the Baskervilles type thing, you know, somebody with a massive hound with phosphorescent on its teeth, frightening people to death. I mean, maybe it's just me, but I really enjoy murder mysteries, I think, rather than what this ended up being, which felt very worthy and is based on a real case and real events. So brilliant. Well done. But it's not as juicy as you might want, is it?
No. You've also got Sherlock as a character who's deals with like addiction and all these other aspects. And Enola being a more child-friendly character is just not going to have those kind of darker aspects that make Sherlock himself perhaps such an icon and made him so different to other detectives as well. Whereas Enola's is quite nice and charming and breaks the fourth wall and could easily be your friend, and you want her to get with Tewkesbury and you want them to live out their nice happy, like, you know, life and solve murders and cause havoc in the House of Lords and all that kind of stuff. It's more nice, and that's fine. I quite like that. I don't like, I was watching it with Sophie, my partner, and she was just like, I really wish I'd had a movie like this when I was younger. And so it is really good for young people to have that kind of role model as well to look up to. So I think it's only a good thing. I wouldn't have been like, oh, rush to the cinema to see this, because I think it does feel also like a Netflix movie somehow. It's got that quality to it. So yeah, if you do find yourself of an evening wanting something to pass 2 hours, that's quite fun and nice. And then this one's definitely for you.
It must be said as well that if you find precocious teenage girls annoying, which you could find Enola extremely irritating with her little asides to the camera and her cheeky little bants, I can see how this could grate a lot on somebody, as well as finding it charming. I personally loved it, but that whole thing that she does is probably a bit of a Marmite, isn't it?
I can totally see that. But I think get over yourself. Just enjoy the fun movie. That's what I say.
So if you fancy Enola Holmes 2, it is on Netflix from Friday. And do stay around. Don't let it just click onto the next thing, onto your next algorithm, because you need to watch the whole film, because there's a little treat in those titles. Right, before we move on, we should draw your attention to our other podcast, The Last Picture Show, which is where we ask famous people and filmmakers, if they had their last night in the cinema, what four films would they program and why? If you've never heard it, it's pretty good. They're quite revealing what people choose. We've had people like Joe Wright, Baz Luhrmann, Amy Lou Wood has done one as well, which is coming up. So if you fancy it, please do search on your podcast platform for Total Film's Last Picture Show. And here's what Joe Wright had to say about his last night at the flicks.
My third pick would actually be a current film called Don't Look Up by Adam McKay. Just brilliant. But it's a satire on the end of the world. Given that we're facing the end of the world in our imaginary scenario, having a movie that makes me laugh out loud about the experience I'm actually going through would be probably quite a good idea.
I mean, this is a starry, starry cast. Is there anyone in that cast that you haven't worked with that you still sort of would like to?
I do think that Jonah Hill smashes it in that movie. And I was speaking to Adam McKay about the film, and he was telling me about all the moments that Jonah improvised, including the prayer he makes to stuff, which is one of the highlights of the movie for me. And I discovered that was all improvised. So yeah, maybe Jonah.
Right. As we're on a feminist theme, Jack, with Enola and the Wonder, shall we get into this?
This is Jane.
How does it work?
Joy?
Yes.
Get in.
No, this is not a taxi. You sit up front with me.
Oh. You're going to rest for a few hours.
Which one of you is Jane?
We're all Jane.
We have organizing meetings. That's the address.
How are you going to get through them all? This 11-year-old girl deserves it.
Well, this lady has cancer.
She was raped.
It has to be random.
It's life or death for some of them.
It's life or death for all of them.
Okay, so this is Call Jane, which is mighty pertinent for the news cycle we're currently in. Tell us about it, Jack.
So Call Jane sees Elizabeth Banks play Joy, a prude, conventional 60s American housewife who dotes on her husband and child and is pregnant. And she's having these near blackouts, and she goes to the doctor and realizes it's linked to the pregnancy, and the doctor advises her to have an abortion, which is currently at this time of the movie in the late 60s, illegal in her state unless under exceptional circumstances. So they petition the hospital board, and the men on the board veto Joy having an abortion despite the pregnancy putting her life at risk. So she instead tries to go down other routes, but is unable to really go through with anything until she reaches out to this mysterious person called Jane, whose number she sees on a poster in town. So she goes to Jane, who is not a single person, but a group of women led by Sigourney Weaver, who help women who are pregnant and need to get abortions get an abortion. So though Joy is still hesitant to get one, she does go through with this act, and it's a very grueling, quite hard to watch scene that's incredibly well acted by Elizabeth Banks. And then Joy goes on to kind of be part of this group helping women out, and Joy must learn to kind of not judge others. And also there's a twists and turns along the way with certain characters. So it's about a woman and these women, the Janes, helping others get abortions in time when they're illegal. I mean, Elizabeth Banks is really great, perhaps never better in this central role. And the messaging is obviously very clear and important right now. The movie is very predictable in where it goes, and it's no spoiler to say like Roe versus Wade is a big part of this ending. And it was made before that was overturned in the States. So I know, Jane, you watched this.
I watched this before. At Sundance when it was quite celebratory to think, thank goodness we don't live in that sort of situation anymore. But you've obviously now seeing it in a very different light. So I'm interested to know how you view a drama that is about real events. The Janes were a real network of women who sort of worked together to provide free abortions to women that literally had no other choice, and safe abortions, because that's one of the tenets of this film, is that outlawing it doesn't stop abortion, it just makes it unsafer. So these women were determined that women were not going to be dying in motel rooms at the hands of really dodgy doctors. They wanted to create this environment that made it safe for them to do that, and basically saved lives, because people were being turned away from having terminations, even if their own life was in danger. So how did it make you feel having the current events around this now? Very different film?
Yeah, I mean, it ends with this celebratory note. It ends with this kind of speech from one of the characters. And then I was expecting almost some text to be like, this has been overturned, to make the point. And perhaps that would have hammered it home a bit too much, but it doesn't end like that. It just kind of ends. I mean, I went straight onto Google and started looking up what's happened in more depth and really trying to understand. The movie really hammers home how important all this is. I'm a naive man, obviously, and this is I'm the sort of person who should probably be watching this movie to really have the point made clearer and understand like why this is so important, which obviously already understood why it's important, but it's good to kind of like really reflect on that for, you know, the 2 hours that this movie does make you do it. And it did have you kind of wanting to know more and trying to understand why we're going back to this time where abortions are illegal. And as I would say, I would have liked the movie to go slightly more in depth on certain things. I mean, it touches on the wider points of like Black women in this narrative, on the church and religion and how all this stuff played out and how it happened. And I guess, especially now that, you know, Roe versus Wade has been overturned, trying to understand why that's happened. It's almost like this movie is coming out probably just the wrong time, because really I want to know why America's gone backwards in that way. You know, I can totally see what this movie is presenting, some of the thinking at that time, but I'm way more interested to know like, why is this happening now? I feel like I always would have been serviced better by a documentary, perhaps, kind of telling the story.
Well, funny you should say that. There is the Janes documentary, which also came out at Sundance, which is just the straightforward documentary and is very much more about the various different experiences of women having illegal abortions and where that left you, near death in a lot of cases, and bleeding heavily in a motel. So yeah, maybe this is a film that you need to watch alongside a documentary like that. To get the full benefit. The thing that's really good about it is showing you the wide gamut of women that need this service, and that you can't just say it's for careless people or it's for people who have been sinful. You know, they show the wide range of reasons that anyone might need to terminate a pregnancy. And I think that's really valuable and useful. And as you say, I think Elizabeth Banks is great in this. I love her as a comedic actress. I haven't really seen her do that much dramatic roles. And I think she's absolutely great in this. And obviously she's up against Sigourney Weaver, who is just, you know, does she ever do anything wrong? She is incredible in everything. So it's really this powerhouse sort of women and powerhouse actresses, and this very, very important story that might feel a little bit homeworky if you're not particularly interested in it, to go and see this as a sort of escape from life.
A lot of what I was thinking while I was watching this was that perhaps for someone like myself who already thinks that people should have the right to have abortions, I guess it affirmed my viewpoint and didn't really do anything to challenge it at all, and therefore was fine. But people who don't have that view, are they going to go see this movie? Are they going to enjoy this? Are they going to have their minds changed? I don't know.
So you think there's an element of preaching to the converted with this as well?
Almost. It just has that feel of it's really hard to, again, to put kind of words to, but I mean the film itself is very well made. The period setting's very good. The wigs are great. The everything.
I didn't have a problem with the wigs. All the wigs are good.
No, And it's very well acted. I mean, some of the, it's very conventional. Some of the music drops, just, it gets the pace going because it does slow down a lot in places, this film. There's not really a reason for someone from the other side of this argument to be like, oh, I should go and see this, unless you just want to see a good performance. And you, if you want to be challenged and you want to see a, yeah, it takes like a white woman from this background who you would think would be anti-abortion and makes her pro-abortion. So I guess if you are someone who's going to go on that character arc with her, then it would be a very important film to see and you should totally go see it. But I don't know how many of those people are going to go see it. And as you said, if it feels homeworky, it's hard to get people out to go see that. Perhaps why a documentary looking at all sides and kind of like understanding why this is so important and why it's happening today. Because I think that's the really important thing, because it is so timely. It feels like it needed that thing to be like, this is what's happened today. You do need someone to say that at the end. I mean, they do it in bloody Enola Holmes too, where they're like, oh, these women were real and they have pictures of the real people. They don't have this with this film, but it would have been better here than with Enola.
Yeah. So if you fancy seeing Call Jane, which obviously is a great name for an organisation, I would say, it is out in cinemas on Friday. Right, it's time for our final film now. Get your accordion out, Jack. It's this.
I'm tired of people thinking I'm some kind of joke.
Your dad and I agreed it would be best if you just stop being who you are and doing the things you love.
My whole life, all I wanted.
I'm afraid we found your son at a polka party.
Just to make up new words to a song that already exists.
Oh, well, you should do that then.
My little hungry one, hungry one. Open up a package of my banana.
Dude, I've got chills.
So this is Weird, the Al Yankovic story. I mean, for those of us who aren't aware of who Weird Al is, tell us.
Well,
maybe you should do it with an accordion or in song.
If I had an accordion, I would totally bust it out right now. But I do not. And I don't fancy singing either. So we'll move on. I mean, Weird Al's famous parody musician behind, you know, music like Eat It, My Bologna, all these things, all these songs that... Was he massive over here? Yes. Yeah, he was. He was bigger in America, but he still, you know, had big hits in the UK. White Nerdy, all sorts. So this is a kind of a biopic about him. It starts with Child Al, who's a young kind of nerdy boy who lives in a staunchly unmusical home with his mum and dad, whose life has changed when a door-to-door salesman comes around with an accordion, and then his father mercilessly beats up the accordion seller. But Al's life has changed. His life's been on a new trajectory. He wants to play the accordion and he's soon at college. And as he's listening to My Sharona on the radio and making a bologna sandwich, he suddenly has a brainwave for a massive hit song. And so starts Weird Al's career, or at least this version of Weird Al's career, because to say it has truth in it, the events aren't truthful.
Some elements of it may be true. I think
some elements may be true, yes, but it is true to Weird Al as a person and creative musician. It's true to the essence of him. It's a biopic that's essentially a parody. Weird Al actually said something really interesting. He said there's as much truth here as there is in Rocket Man, the Elton John movie. And it's kind of taking that idea of, well, biopics stretch the truth. How far can we go with that? And how much fun can we have with that? So it's a movie that's just like a Weird Al song. It's a parody of these biopics. I mean, it's got Daniel Radcliffe playing Weird Al. Daniel Radcliffe looks nothing like Weird Al. They are like, there's like a foot difference in their height as well. Daniel Radcliffe also shredded, huge six pack. Just
you are obsessed with this.
I mean, disclaimer, I grew up with Harry Potter on screen. I was like same age. I interviewed Daniel Radcliffe for the mag for this. I've interviewed him before. Very nice guy. But my mum was essentially like, oh, it feels like you're meeting up with your friends from school. And I was like, no, it's not. So it's very funny that this guy who is the like dork in these movies is suddenly huge and stacked, and people are like, oh, he's going to play Wolverine, and you're like, what?
But not that I've, you know, studied Daniel Radcliffe's torso over the years, but he has always been like that as an adult. He was like that in Equus when he went on stage. And if you saw The Miracle Workers when he did Coming Round the Mountain with a feather boa and some leather chaps, then you've already seen this. It's not news, Jack.
Okay, maybe it's not news, but seeing him like on stage in this movie doing that, ripping off a shirt, and he's topless for quite some time. Like they like playing around with this. The director loves playing around with it and showing it off. It's just very funny, and it's not like Weird Al IRL, you know? So it's, again, it's this parody aspect, this kind of poking fun, and the whole movie does that. I mean, there is one thing in the middle, which I won't spoil, but it was the moment where it clicked in my brain what this movie was. It took a while.
If it's the same bit that I had, because I kind of was like mildly amused and sort of, mm-hmm. And then it got to this one scene at a swimming pool party. Is that the one for you?
Yes.
With Roger Deakin and various other famous people that clearly were never at that party, and Al proving his genius by singing Another One Rides the Bus by his Queen thing, that tipped it suddenly from mildly amusing to absolute genius for me. And it was literally that particular song and Daniel Radcliffe's absolute just straight-faced dedication to it, and his friends like making fart noises with their hands in the background, that just suddenly it became a whole other thing. And then obviously it goes into this flight of fantasy about Michael Jackson, about Madonna, that you then like, I'm totally into this. And by the end of it, I was just like, I need to start that from the beginning, feeling the way I did at the end, because I really wasn't sure at the start, but it totally seduced me. And let's talk about the famous folk that are in this. There's just cameos galore as well.
Yeah, Jack Black, Conan O'Brien, all these people are in it. And then you've also got Evan Rachel Wood as Madonna.
And she doesn't really look like Madonna either, but she sounds very much like her. She talks exactly like her. She's got that that cadence of Madonna, and I thought that was brilliant. But yeah, it's crazy the amount of different people that turn up in this.
And everything's turned up to 11. I mean, if we told you that you see Weird Al kung fu fighting and like taking on Mexican drug lords and yep. all this stuff, you wouldn't believe me, but that does happen.
Yeah, and Escobar does feature.
And Daniel Radcliffe is really funny in this. I mean, he's been funny in movies like Lost City of D and Swiss Army Man. I mean, he was the evil English guy in Lost City, not Lost City of D. It used to be called Lost City of D.
It's just called Lost City. Yes. Yeah. Lost its D.
Lost its D. But not its Daniel. And he's funny in all these things. But in this, I found him just hilarious. It was done in a way that was still surprising. Despite his career having all these curveballs, it was still surprising how funny he was and how much he committed to the bit. And what was amazing was that they made it in like 18 days or something ridiculous. It was just like made it so quickly. Yet they turned around this really funny movie. It's really surprising that it's going on the Roku channel. I mean, I didn't really know about before. And this is, I think it's their first original movie, so hence why I probably don't really know about it. But it's amazing that someone like Netflix or someone didn't just chomp this up and take it straight away, because it works, and it's the idea of Dan Radcliffe playing Weird Al is inherently funny anyway.
In a really bad wig, intentionally so, and a ridiculous moustache. It's just funny. It's like what Saturday Night Live should be. Although when you watch Saturday Night Live, you're like, what? Why is this show not funny? It just never is. It never quite gets there. And this, tonally, I think that's what's so good about it, is they nail the tone and everybody's on the same page with that. Jack Black is great in this. He turns up and he's brilliant in this one scene. But it's tone, isn't it? And making sure that they're all playing it absolutely seriously, but also just slightly tweaked and not. And that sort of heightened sense of it is what makes it really, really amusing.
And it's a good reminder of just how funny Weird Al's songs are as well.
Yes.
Like, I hadn't listened to him in years, and then you want the Spotify playlist up of
like,
all this
like
stuff.
Like a Surgeon to Madonna's Like a Virgin. Genius.
Yeah, it's really funny. And it goes to really unexpected places as well that are just hilarious. And it really does surprise me that it's not coming out in cinemas in a big way. I really think it will have a Rocky Horror Show future where it's played in the Prince Charles cinema every year with sing-alongs and stuff like that, because I think it's gonna have that cult following.
Yeah,
for sure, right?
Bring your accordions and your bologna sandwiches and off we go. It's a good time. So if you fancy a bit of Weird, the Al Yankovic story, It's a Roku from this Friday. So it's now time for Star Wars Character Wars, which we started last week. We had Han Solo versus Chewbacca. Han Solo won on the pod. Han Solo also won on Twitter by 76%. Han is better than Chewie. Sorry, Chew. So this week, Han goes up against who, Jack?
Han Solo is kind of the coolest character in the galaxy far, far away. And so you're never going to beat him with someone dorky like Luke. You know, it's someone as proud and cool as Leia. So I think you kind of need to go completely the other way and just choose the baddest badass in the galaxy far, far away. That is, of course, Darth Vader, the evil, most evil character there is, who was the central focus of the brilliant prequel trilogy as well. His origin story. Is there a villain as iconic as the bucket headed Darth Vader? I don't know. I mean, he shows up for 30 seconds in a spin-off movie called Rogue One, and it's all anyone can talk about.
Yeah.
He is just, he's not cool. He's terrifying. He is just so brilliant as an icon of cinema. Han Solo has the cool factor, but Darth Vader just has that staying power where you could show anyone his outline and you'll know who that is.
Yeah. Okay. That is tough. I've got to fight Han for that. So like, I see what you're saying. And also like, would Han or anyone else really exist in this world if it wasn't for the machinations of the evil Darth Vader? You know, his sort of narrative impact is huge as well, isn't it? So Vader, yes, he's cool, but is he absolutely unique? You can put anyone under that bucket hat. You can't put anyone in Han Solo's little jerkin with his blaster. So, you know, like, as a sort of completely unique character, as played by Harrison Ford, is Vader better? Discuss.
I don't think you can put anyone in there, because the point that made Vader really iconic, right, was in Empire Strikes Back, when it was the, you know, I am your father line.
Yes.
And it's having a villain who, you know, he could have been Sauron, he could have been pure evil, he could have been all that, but he has that familial connection, he has the depth and the backstory, and obviously we go into it in, you can think what you want about the prequels. I mean, they're tricky films to love. But again, as I've already said, I grew up with the Harry Potter movies, which means I also grew up at a similar time as the prequel movies. So I have a childhood fondness for them. Mm. And I don't think that can take away from the impact that Vader has in the main trilogy. And also the way that Vader's story in even the third movie, Revenge of the Sith, kind of makes that movie, seeing Hayden Christensen's character turn evil, having the moment he steps into the suit. Even the new Obi-Wan Kenobi series wouldn't have been a blip on anyone's radar, really, if it was just Obi-Wan's story, but it was the fact that he was going against Vader. People wanted the rematch of the century. They wanted that. And it was because it was Vader, this character with the history with Obi-Wan Kenobi. And also people were excited to see Hayden back in that role.
Yeah.
It was him. It wasn't just like, you know, someone acting underneath the suit with James Earl Jones's voice, or, you know, it was the fact it was him under there doing what he did. And so I think that speaks volumes to the character and the power of him. And also there is still, although these films are very much kind of about him, there's still a bit of mystique around Vader. It's hard to put together sometimes the idea of like him having gone through that journey and being as evil as he is, as terrifying as he is, maybe that would be somewhat broken if there was like a Vader series, but there isn't. He's always a part of someone else's.
You don't
stories.
Know. Never say never.
They 100% are going to make one, aren't
they? Of course they are.
All right, let's look at Back to the Future, okay? When Vader comes and terrifies Marty's father in the past, and you didn't need any story there. You just needed the recreation and pretend of Vader. He pretends to be Vader, doesn't he?
No, he just dresses up in a suit, but he does the voice, I guess.
But even from just that voice, you think he's pretending to be Vader, okay? That's what I'm saying. It's so iconic. It's so huge. Like, what are you going to do for Han Solo? Like, put a blaster into thing? Harrison Ford did it again with Indy. Indy's a better character than Han, I think. So there you go.
I think, do you know what? I think you've sold me there. I actually am going to, yeah, I think you're probably right. And, you know, who hasn't walked through B&Q as a child or any sort of superstore with the doors that open automatically and pretended to be Vader swooping along corridors? I have. Everybody knows who he is. Everybody has a feeling about him, mostly unpleasant. Although, you know, with Adam Driver, people had some warm sexual feelings about him there as well. So runs the gamut. So yeah, I think, Jack, I'm going to say on this one, you've actually won. I think Vader has probably won, but we will put it to the Twitter test and we'll find out, because it will be quite interesting to see if he can beat Han Solo. So please join us on Twitter to let us know. Our poll is up now. Right, that's it for this week. Before we go, we should ask, could you please subscribe to our pod? We love having people that are subscribers. We think about you just before we drop off to sleep at night. So please do. And we have time for one last question from a listener. So this is a good one, Jack. What food stuff have you tried because you saw it in a movie?
Quite a lot, actually. But I will keep it to a minimum. I would choose the one big one was, and it's a weird one, so prepare yourself. But you know in Phantom Thread?
Yes.
The Paul Thomas Anderson movie, you know the poisonous mushroom?
Oh, yes. Oh, God, how far did you go with that? Were you dying on the floor?
No poison, but I really wanted to try mushrooms because I was like, they must be really good if you're willing to like get really ill from eating them. And I used to hate mushrooms, and then I just hadn't tried them in years. And then I was like, fine, let's get some mushroom soup. That'll be fun. And also because I'd watched it with my partner and she was just like, that's really weird. And I was like, well, I'm doing it now because you've said that. And now I really, really like mushrooms. And so I had this mushroom soup and I was like, this is great. This is so good. I totally, totally get it now. So now I'm really into mushrooms thanks to Phantom Thread, which is quite weird.
So you can tell Daniel Day-Lewis that when you next see him. Thanks. I enjoy mushrooms now, thanks to your thing. Anything else? Have you tried Twinkies or anything else because you've seen them on films?
No, I mean, I once got really nerdy and ate the food along with what they were eating in Lord of the Rings. Whenever they ate like salted pork or something like that, I also ate salted pork. So that was fun. You're looking at me like,
the Lord of the Rings depth of fandom is ridiculous, honestly. Well,
I mean, at the moment, my thing is like, I find out what week they're doing next week for Bake Off and get the food in. So like with pastry week, we had pie. And with...
So this is a real thing for you. You are literally easily suggestible. If you see food on screen, you pretty much need to shove it in your gob.
I get really hungry. Bake Off is really bad. I eat so many biscuits, crazy amounts of biscuits when I'm watching it. It's really bad. When you're trying to like lose weight and stuff, it's awful. So yeah, that really makes me quite hungry. Do you not get this? Are you not like this?
I do like to try things. So I mean, I think I probably did eat a Twinkie because everybody in every film seems to eat Twinkies, which are vile, obviously. I haven't tried a deep fried Twinkie, which I think they had on Vengeance. There was lots of foodstuffs in Vengeance that I have eaten before I saw the film, like the Cheeto pie that is just Cheetos with mince on top that you eat with a spoon. But the one that I did try that I was intrigued by was fried green tomatoes, because I'd seen them in the Whistle Stop Cafe. So when I went to Georgia, I did try those. I do like food films. There is something really nice about watching something like Water for Chocolate or something like that, where people are creating something. Even that fondant that they make in the Grand Budapest Hotel, I wanted to taste that. I wish somebody made that. I wish that bakery was real. I would absolutely queue up to buy one of those. What was it? Fondant au chocolat or something. And there was the recipe in the film. It's like, oh my God. And the other one that was made was Puerco Pibble that Johnny Depp's character orders in Once Upon a Time in Mexico, which was very nice.
So you do eat a lot of food from what you've seen on screen. You too are susceptible like me.
It's not that I want to shove stuff in my mouth like you do while I'm watching it. But if I do see a delicious dish, I do want to go and have it or make it afterwards. I am always intrigued by that. Any kind of recipe that comes up in a film, I'm like, oh, I wonder what that actually does taste like. Haven't tasted anything really weird, but apart from Twinkies, because they're horrible. But yeah. So if you are also a foodie, let us know on Twitter. But otherwise, it's time to say goodbye, Jack. So say goodbye.
Goodbye.
And we'll be back next week with more. Goodbye.
Too white and nerdy. Can't you see I'm white and nerdy? Look at me, I'm white and nerdy. I wanna roll with the gangsters, but so far they all think I'm too white and nerdy. Think I'm just too white and nerdy. Think I'm just too white and nerdy. I'm just too white and nerdy. Really, really white and nerdy.
First in my class there at MIT. Got skills, I'm a champion of D&D. MC Escher, that's my favorite MC. Keep your